Well, you're speaking right now to the last black columnist at the Washington Post right now, given.
Wow, that is unacceptable.
I will say in the opinion section specifically, there are some on the news, but opinion writer.
This is Justice by Design, and I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. For those watching this on video, you will see I'm not in my normal work room. I am actually on the beautiful coast of Oak Bluffs, Massachusetts, where I will be participating in a panel discussion hosted by the Alumni Association of my alma mater, Boston University, where I went to law school and grad school, to talk about how college campuses can create and protect safe spaces for students to be able to engage in one another, including on tough topics, without fear of retribution or being punished in some way for engaging in that, because that's such an important part of education. And I'm super happy and honored and excited to be a part of that conversation. And listen, synergy is real, because it also happens that today, for Justice by Design, my guest is one of the trailblazers when it comes to creating those spaces and not letting obstacles stand in her way. I am honored to be joined today by Karen Atiya, who is the founder of Resistance Summer School. Hi, Karen.
Hey, Kim. Thanks for having me.
Of course. So good to see you. So as always, I ask my guests to give a very brief introduction of themselves so that the listeners can know what you do with the Resistance Summer School and elsewhere. You have many irons and many fires. then we can get started. So tell us a little bit about yourself, Karen.
Sure, sure. Yes. Many irons and many fires. Feels like both on a sort of personal busyness side, but then also a political side. There are many fires.
Yes.
So, yes. My more or less day job is I'm a journalist. I've been with the Washington Post for the last almost 11 years, about 11 years. And, most people probably know me through my work as a columnist and as an editor in the opinion section for the Washington Post. And for me, I think my childhood dream in general was to, I always just liked having discussions and asking questions. And I think I actually wanted to be a philosopher when I was a kid.
Interesting.
I would just walk around carrying big stacks of books because I thought maybe by osmosis, if I carried them, I would gain, the wisdom of the ages or something. So I always thought I wanted to be a professor, a teacher, a philosopher. So, my actual kind of background, I never studied journalism. I never went to journalism school. My background is actually in international affairs and human rights. So I just always saw our world as closer than we think. So I went to Columbia School of International and Public Affairs, got my grad school degree, my master's in international affairs and human rights. And just that's really what shaped me as a journalist, as a person. I just was like, I want to learn as much as I can about the world through other people. And I took that into my work as a journalist. And I focused in my work as a journalist on human rights, but particularly with a focus on Africa, Africans, the Black world, and have always argued for centering our experiences, our histories, and sort of excavating the histories that were purposefully erased, that were lost to time, to erasure, to racism.
And for a time, you created a course at Columbia that focused on the intersection of journalism and race and international studies, basically all of those wheelhouses together. Tell us about that class.
Right. Yeah. I had been well, I maintained, you know, relationships with Columbia, with the School of International and Public Affairs for a long time. So for years, they're like, please come back and teach. Please come back and teach. And I was like, not yet. I'm not ready. Not ready. But even in those years, I still began developing basically the syllabus and the course I never had as a student. As a student at Columbia, I just, you know, we were learning about international development and these theories of international relations. And I just realized, I was like, well, where are the stories, where are the histories that are non-white, non-Western, non-male? They weren't there. And race was really never something that was explicitly brought up when it came to how we look at the world. And I just was like, this doesn't make sense. Yeah. So I just started creating this curriculum and finding books that really explicitly address this. And yes, you know, finally said yes, yes to the dress. I don't know. Yes to the opportunity to teach in spring 2024. And the course was, we put it up and immediately there was a huge student demand and it actually was over enrolled at Columbia. We had to expand the class spaces. And I begin with the genesis actually of the United Nations. And the attempts to actually bring racial equality to the League of Nations and how that was rejected by then President Woodrow Wilson and the UK and Australia. And it's something that most people don't know. Right. And so, yeah, I was like, all right, let's learn about the things we didn't know. In many ways, it's a remedial history class. So I taught it. It went very well. I enjoyed it. And then a few months later, I was told that my course would not be renewed for funding. And that was crushing, obviously. I mean, not just for me, but crushing for the students.
Were you ever given a reason from Columbia?
To this day, the... Wow. To this day, the reasons... And I emailed. I was like, what is it? It clearly isn't enrollment. It clearly wasn't... complaints. It clearly, you know, wasn't, you know, any of the reasons that they'd given for other course cancellations. So I never got a direct reason, but of course there were rumors, there were speculations. I was quite outspoken about what I considered to be the genocide in Gaza, Israel's actions contributing to the massive Palestinian suffering and death. So I was very critical of that. I was critical of how the administration, how the Columbia administration stomped on its students' right to protest said brutality. And, you know, it's hard for me not to believe that my political stances on those issues led to my course being canceled.
And the subsequent, you know, as we lawyers call it, circumstantial evidence that it abounds, given everything that it has happened with Columbia, I would say that where there is smoke, there is fire. I went to Columbia Graduate School as well. I went to the journalism school, which for people who don't know, there was a lot of crossover between the journalism school and SIPA. Mm-hmm. Those graduate programs, a lot of times the classes that I took were also SIPA classes. They were marked for both. And I met a lot of SIPA students there because it makes perfect sense, right? When you're talking about international studies, when you're talking about international policies and how the world works, we need to be able to explain that and dig into that and learn about that at the time. So I have been quite vocally unhappy with my alma mater. In a way, I wish that they would sponsor things like my other graduate alma mater, BU, is doing here on Martha's Vineyard that I'm a part of. And I'm very disappointed. And I've let them know about that disappointment. But you, Karen, not to be stopped, and knowing that this is a class that got a lot of attention, that had a lot of interest, and that people were really clamoring for, did something else. You created your own school. That's fascinating. Tell us about Resistance Summer School.
Yeah, I mean, this honestly came out of, Columbia canceled the class. I didn't go public about that. I was told not to go public about that. I was told to just wait it out. Maybe we can have you back. Maybe in 2026, 2027, when all this blows over. And I just was like, the fire's here now, right? Yeah. The banning of teaching about race, even the banning of anything that has to do with diversity, anything considered quote unquote woke or whatever, that fire is here now. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think for me, I kept quiet. And then when I saw Columbia caving to the Trump administration, when I saw them further consider curtailing academic rights, freedom of speech rights, I was just like, why should I let the work that I've done in their name? Why should I wait for them to get their act together? Maybe. Yeah. And then teach with this specter of, oh, the axe could come from my head at any time. Oh, again. Right. And I guess so. This was really just out of not even a whim. I wasn't even really thinking about it. Again, I love teaching so much. And I was sad about not having an opportunity to get better at teaching. I mean, you know, so I just put out a post on Blue Sky. I was like, hey guys, I've got this course on race and media. Would any of y'all be interested? And honestly, Kim, I would have been super happy if like 20 people signed up. I would have been like, great. Like, that'll be a great kind of intimate seminar. I could make maybe a little money on the side and I could still keep perfecting this course, still keep getting better for me. That's what I was thinking. And I think also, like a lot of people, I was also feeling powerless at everything that was happening in terms of the institutions crumbling, a bit hopeless. And I was like, what could I do that's like not just shouting? I don't know, like I write columns, but it feels sometimes like it goes into a void. Yeah. And I was like, well, this is what my offering. So, but what I did not expect was, yeah, like I said, 20 or 30 people, I would have been like, cool, boom, let's find a tree. We'll meet under it. Like, let's go. What happened was 2,000 people responded.
Wow.
And I was like, oh, okay, we've got something here. And I to this day, I still can't explain the sequence of it. Like, there's something in my head just like, keep going. Yeah. Okay. So people said they were interested. People said that they would be willing to pay. And I was like, okay, we got something. And then finally, my friends were like, just put up the links, Karen. Just open it up. Just do it. And I created like a tiered system so you could pay according to what you could basically afford, from as, you know, for 7 weeks, six, 7 weeks, as little as $100 all the way up to, you know, 200, 300, you know, mm-hmm. Again, to be able to get access to what I taught at an Ivy League level. That was,
let me tell you, would have cost much more.
Yes, exactly.
Ooh, much more. I paid Columbia an exorbitant amount of money for my degree. So you're giving it at a bargain.
Knowledge.
Well, let me ask you this, because for me, probably for a lot of people, the idea of just, okay, well, I'll just create this thing on my own would seem daunting. Were you daunted by, I mean, you clearly had support from people around you, which is crucially important. Mm-hmm. But did you ever think, oh, wow, can I really do this? What made you so certain that you could think out of the box in this way, and just, you know, if the institution that you were in wasn't serving you, you built your own institution?
I mean, I can't say I was always certain. I think the key to it all is moving anyway, right? Mm-hmm. I remember when I, you know, moving from, especially as a journalist, like moving from people clicking to actually asking people, will you open your wallet for this? I remember being like panicked, like opening the, like actually asking people to commit and be like, what have I done? Oh my gosh, it's going to look stupid. It's people maybe, yes, they'll click the heart, but they're not actually going to join me. They're not actually going to commit time. And then what happened was, the spot sold out in 48 hours.
Wow.
500 spots sold out in 48 hours.
Wow.
So I think then I was like, all right, let's go. Now we have enough to, now I was like, okay, I've got the syllabus. Now I can bring on someone who can at least help with the logistics And I just think the energy of it like attracted people who were also seeing that there was something here. And I think that combo, just having the right combination of people, and we got a website, we got someone from the Martin Luther King Jr. Library here in DC reached out to me on Blue Sky. They were like, hey, we saw what you're doing. We've got space for you if you want it. I was like, bet, let's go. And it just worked. Okay, it just flowed. It just worked.
I have to say, when I saw your announcement of the summer school and you were stand, like before I even clicked the video, I saw that you were stand and I recognized where you were immediately. Oh. And I squealed, because the MLK Library in DC is such a special and important place culturally. I mean, I saw Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson speak there because she comes from a family of educators from from DC, and that she chose that place to give her book talk because of that importance. And when I saw you standing there, I was just like, yeah.
Oh, that's so cool.
And yeah. I love how you talked. I mean, you're talking about all kinds of people, stakeholders, and people buying into this idea, mm-hmm. which allowed it to move forward and come together so quickly. But you shouted out librarians in that mm-hmm. announcement, which I also love. Say more about that.
I mean, just even from my work as a columnist, I covered, when I was in Texas the last couple of years, I was covering a lot of the sort of the book banning, the attacks on education. So I interviewed a lot of just badass librarians who were like, nah, we are going to protect this library. We are going to hold the line, because we are not just about the books themselves, but they are stewards of community. And they are often the ones that, whether it's kids to adults who are not only searching for knowledge, but searching for belonging, like often it's librarians who are helping people sort of find their place in the world. So again, when shout out to Michelle Casto at the MLK Library, when she saw, and also the MLK Library, very specifically, I think it resonated with them. And I didn't know this actually, back in, I want to say 2000, maybe during the pandemic, a few years ago, basically, they were commemorating the history of the teach-ins. And so they put together their own People's University. And so they were having courses open to the public there. And so what they were telling me is, when they saw what I was hoping to do or trying to do, they were like, yes, the People's University lives, like can bring it back. Now, of course, you know, we were renting the space, so it isn't, you know, an official kind
sure,
of,
but yes.
It's the synergy and the history just made the sense and made sense. And it's just, I don't know. It just, to me, I still can't explain how all of this came together so perfectly and divinely, honestly. But yeah, with librarians, and I have a lot of librarians in my class, in the Race, Media, and International Affairs is the name of the course. And mm-hmm. I call it Resistance Summer School to go back to why, just because I think I just posted a tweet. It's like when people signed up for the class, and I just put out a tweet like, get in everyone, we're going to summer school. We're going to Resistance Summer School. I was joking, but it caught on. And I think for a lot of people, I mean, two things. Like, I think, first of all, summer school, it evokes that fun feeling. Let's get our notebooks. Let's get our pens. Let's get our backpacks. And let's fight back by just going to learn. And I think a lot of people do want to fight back, but in a way that I won't say is low risk per se, but is accessible. Not everyone wants to get out in the streets. Not everyone can. But this way, it really is a way of saying, oh, you're going to try to cancel this stuff? You can't stop us. Right.
Yeah.
So I think with librarians, same thing. I've watched them for years try to go around these restrictions, this increasing climate of censorship and suppression. Yeah. So, yeah. They are badasses.
Mm-hmm. That is real. And I share that back. I mean, libraries, from the point that I could read, which I could read by the time I was four, because my mother loved reading and she stayed in libraries and she always took me into libraries, and I could read before I could tie my shoes, and the doors were open. You know, this is pre-internet. I'm 52 years old. There was no, you know, it was still Dewey Decimal Systeming back in those days. But it was the librarians, the people who helped me open the doors and find the knowledge and sort of opened a new world to what could be known as a nerdy little kid. So that's why that resonated so much with me. Why, just a little bit about the class and how it's going, because it's you're about halfway through it now.
Yeah.
So how has it been going? Tell us a little bit about what the class is.
Yeah, so again, it's connecting the dots between race, media, and by media, I mean mostly news media, and global affairs. So the first week, you know, I really ground in, like I said, most people, you know of the United Nations, but they might not have known that even back in 1919, at the sort of right after World War One, you've got Jim Crow South in the U.S. You're having these countries that are seeing that the West versus the rest is becoming this dividing line around the world, right? And so I really ground sort of the unknown history of the attempts by non-Western countries to say, hey, West, there is owed to every human being a level of dignity and respect, regardless of where they come from. And all the Japanese delegation wanted was to have a few lines in that charter. And so I guess for me, I ask the students after we learned that those few lines were rejected, and not only were those few lines rejected, but the Western press did not cover these deliberations barely at all, whereas the rest of the world were watching keenly at what the Japanese delegation was trying to do.
Yeah.
So it puts a lot of to ask this question of, first of all, as journalism, as we know it today, what do journalists choose to see, what do they choose to not see, and what are the implications of that? And what does it mean that we didn't know this history? Why were we not taught this? Not only about Woodrow Wilson, who we laud as this progressive figure, you know, and so I ground the class, and every week, you know, we're talking about these events and looking at how they were covered or not covered. And I'm looking at the trajectory of media development and seeing that there are actually parallel tracks with race relations, both in the US and the world, with that, basically this question of how did we get here, these stereotypes that existed in media, also seeing that racism, particularly in the US media, helped sell newspapers, right?
Yeah.
Like hearing about barbarous Indians back in 1690, helped sell the first paper. So I ask my students a lot of times when people are sitting and watching their news today and they're like, how did we get here? This class is an answer to that. And I'm like, they were doing this nonsense in 1690.
Yeah.
Right. Oh. And so I think for a lot of my students so far, so it's a mix of me lecturing. Then we have guest speakers. This week we talked about the Chinese American experience, particularly in California, and how California really was probably one of the original American experiments in multiracial democracy with the gold rush. So attracting the Irish, the Germans, the California, you know. So I think for a lot of people, and then thinking about immigration, we tend to look at it through a sort of Latino only lens, which makes sense, you know, now, but originally it was a Chinese issue. Yeah. So I think for a lot of people, this is the first time learning it. And I think for us, I tell my students a lot of people, we feel kind of angry, a little ashamed that we didn't know. And I think it's all of us working.
I didn't have a course anything like that.
Right.
Yeah. I didn't have a course anything like that in journalism school. And I would have loved to have had that, because
you
that
can
is
still
so
have it. Sign up. No, I think for journalists, especially, it's important.
Crucial to understanding for everyone, but particularly journalists. Listen, when I have often explained that when there were diversity and DEI pushes within newsrooms, that it would be useless if it was just about how many faces there were in the newsroom or what this and that. The purpose is so that the people writing about the news have a contextual understanding about what they're reporting and how that fits into the broader world and how to recognize what is happening. Like when, you know, right now, for example, the Department of Homeland Security keeps doing these social media posts about remember our heritage on the frontier, showing white people in like covered carriages out on the Oregon Trail and whatnot. And I'm like, okay, there's a lot more to this story. And this is basically a white nationalist view of America, when actually, as you said, the frontier out west was not only bloody and brutal for indigenous people, but you had Latin immigrants, you had Chinese immigrants, you had black people who thought they would have a better shot out west than they did in the south that were homesteading too. It's a story. It's a complex story. It's an important story, but tell it right. But we have our own government that's not telling it right. Anyway, yeah. I can go on all day about this.
Not just not telling it right.
Right.
I mean, even what you described, I've seen those images coming from the Department of Homeland Security. It's chilling because that is straight up racial propaganda.
Yes.
That is straight up. And, you know, I think part of even, you know, a future course that I want to do is how do we distinguish between, you know, media and news and straight up propaganda.
Yes.
Right. And so, yeah, exactly. It's to see that the story of the U.S. is both complicated and sort of not complicated, in the sense that this is long. Mm. This is one long experiment in if multiracial democracy is possible. Yeah. And I think I agree with you that diverse DEI trainings, and particularly when it comes to journalism, isn't just about treating each other nice in the workplace, although that's obviously important so that people can function and do their jobs. And right. But it's also about realizing that all of us were robbed of the full story of America. And I keep joking to my students, I'm like, you know, I should just name this a remedial history course. We're all in remedial history 101. Right. Yes. As told through the lens of media development. And again, yeah. For me, putting it in a global context, and not just America. I mean, a lens through America, but just realizing, you know, that this, you know, that we'll talk about how Africa has been viewed, the black press and the efforts of Pan-Africanism and things like that. So, yeah. It's, you know, a very broad overview, but what I love about the experience so far is the students. I have everyone. I think the youngest student is 17. The oldest might be approaching their 80s. Most people are watching online. We live stream on Zoom every evening, live from the MLK Junior Library. And then there's the option to watch the videos, you know, on your own and read the readings on your own at your own pace and own time. But what is so amazing is just how hungry people are for not only for knowledge, but for community. And I think what I really am trying to do is to create a safe space for these discussions about race and about what we know and what we don't know. And what I'm finding is people are, I think people feel safe to be able to at least discuss, at least ask questions, at least be more curious, I think, about this class maybe being a prompt and saying, you know what, I want to study a bit more about this on my own, right? Who are the figures that we're learning about? You know, the first Chinese American newspaper that really fought for Chinese people to have the right to vote, it happened in the late 1800s, like, Wang Chunfu, like, let's learn more about this. Why don't we consider him a civil rights figure, right? Like, or why do we only have, again, like I said, particularly in journalism, certain silos for certain things. Civil rights is a black thing. Race is a black thing. Immigration is a Latino thing.
Right.
Right. You know, so it's just challenging all these boxes to an extent, and hopefully encouraging people not only to learn more, but because it's summer and I specifically was strategic about this, there are a lot of teachers in my class. There are a lot of archivists in my class. So it means that they can go and think about how to teach whatever classrooms they'll be in come fall. So yeah, it's definitely been really, it's just been really, it gives me hope. You know,
it gives me hope too. Mm-hmm. So my last question to you is, we're both newspaper columnists. And I think a great deal, I mean, you said, you know, screaming into the void or something like that. I feel like that's what I do every single week in some ways. Mm-hmm. Even though I do get encouragement from listeners, from readers about what I'm trying to do. What advice would you give to me and the others in the media as we're trying to traverse these spaces and speak, you know, tell the truth, as in the words of Ida B. Wells, and do that job in these times?
Well, you're speaking right now to the last Black columnist at the Washington Post right now, given...
That is, wow, that is unacceptable.
Yeah, but, I will say in the opinion section specifically, there are some on the news, but opinion writer. Let's say by the time this airs, I don't know what my status will be, I'm sad to say. So that being said, my thought and my advice, especially right now, is to write like hell. Right? We are up against forces, particularly, I would argue, and I've said this for years, particularly when it comes to Black women having public platforms. Yeah. Oh my God. This is opinion platforms and not being constrained by, you know, these these ideas of objectivity and leaving yourself out of it and all that.
Right.
There is an outright assault. And they want to remove us from the public sphere. And I would just say, even if you think you're writing into the void, you're not. It's important. And my class even is showing why it's important, because there's so many pockets of history that we don't know because the white journalist, the white male journalist, did not think it was important. And so when we say journalists are the first draft of history, it really is true. When we see that something has happened, this lays the groundwork for historians, for filmmakers, for other information workers to build upon that. So it is so important to document what's happening right now. It is so important to keep paper copies of what we're doing right now. As amazing as the internet is and as digitization is, I also think about sometimes how ephemeral these things are. I think it's time for all of us to study. I actually feel, regardless of what happens with me in journalism right now, I feel I'm never going to stop writing. That is for damn sure. And I think right now it's a time to really dig deep and think about, what are you willing to give right now? What are you maybe willing to give up? I think for your values in this time, it's going to be different for everyone, but I can say for me, I just have always been guided. I'll never forget at NABJ, I think it was Reverend Jesse Jackson kind of told us, jobs come and go, but your work, your mission remains. Mm. And I think for me, my mission, just same with whether it's going to be through teaching, whether it's going to be through writing, I'm still going to be sharing and reflecting the world back to others and helping to process this. And that's all I think that we can do, that we're all just trying to process this world together and hopefully write a better story for America, you know, and inspire other people to, I don't know, to live out your values, I guess.
A better story, a truer story.
A truer story, a better story.
Yes.
More inclusive one. And yeah, for sure.
Karen, thank you so much for joining me today. And how can people learn more about Resistance Summer School?
Sure. So we've got resistancesummerschool.com is our website. You can follow me on Substack at karenatia.substack.com, and you'll see a Resistance Summer School tab there. We have a waiting list. If you go to our website, we will be opening the fall enrollment soon. So if you get on the waiting list, you'll be the first to know when we open that up for our next cohort, which will begin in September. And yes, you can follow me on Blue Sky, Instagram, Twitter, maybe sometimes I'm still on there, but yes, at Karen Atiyah on all platforms.
Wonderful. Karen Atiyah, thank you so much for joining me on Justice by Design.
Thank you. Thank you. It was a pleasure.
And thanks to all of you for listening to Justice by Design. If you are not following this podcast wherever you get your pods, please do so now. And also leave a review if you like what you're hearing, because it helps other people find it. I will be back next week with another issue. And I'm talking so much about writing. I'm in that mode, right? I'm going to be back next week with another episode of Justice by Design. Until then, take care. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store.